Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Our clerk will call the second case, please.
The court will now call Christopher Hill King versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Tony E. Kelton will argue for the appellate. Mr. David Pearl will argue for the state.
Good afternoon. I am glad to be here. It's good to see you. If it will please the court and counsel, I want to talk about, I don't know, does the court want me to start talking or have I jumped ahead?
Pardon me?
Light, sir.
My light is not.
There we go.
Okay, there we go.
Go with green.
All right. With the green light, I would like to, well, first of all, I am here on behalf of appellant Christopher King. I'd like to talk about first towing, then the issue of consent, and if time allows, clock watching. The state's brief cites a variety of cases, and I assume I didn't really look deeply into these towing cases throughout the country, but pretty good survey of towing cases. And I'm calling it that because the argument is that a traffic stop is not completed until the officers have finished an inventory of a vehicle and the car has been towed. Finally, a traffic stop is over. The state cites first, well, actually, I'm not sure which order they are in the brief, but there's a New York case, People versus Willett. If you actually take the time to read the case, you see that it's easily distinguished from our situation in that the appellant in that case is the only person in the vehicle that could not legally drive, and it is a search of the vehicle itself as opposed to a search of the person. The vehicle has to stay within the care of law enforcement. They are impounding it. So it's not as though it is an unlawful possession or seizure of the vehicle that led to the search. In our case, we have an unlawful extension of the detention that leads to a search. State also cites Rainey out of Oregon, I believe. And again, this is where the defendant has been stopped. We're not dealing with a passenger. But the facts of the case are the officer is waiting on information to get back to through dispatch or whatever system they have, and during that time, reasonable suspicion arises, which is similar to the law in Texas and the law that we have from the United States Supreme Court. Rainey doesn't really get into this impound or towing question. It does cite very briefly one sentence. I went and I looked at the case that it actually relies on and borrows the impound language from, and that's Boatman from the same court. And in Boatman, which you'll find the citation within Rainey, but it's 185 Oregon Court of Appeals 27, there is no evidence that at the time that consent was asked for that the traffic stop was completed. In this situation, you have where the officer has not issued a citation, and there is paperwork that a person is required to fill out by law in order to turn the vehicle over to officers. That hasn't been completed whenever the officer obtains consent. And that is Boatman cited by Rainey. The only case that I think is, well, and then there's a Utah case, Berriala, once again, goes along with our law here in Texas. There's a stop. During the stop, there are articulable facts that come to the officer's attention that justify an extension of the detention and ultimately a search. Those facts were that it was 65 degrees and this guy's bundled up, sweating, high crime area. Officer testifies about, you know, in my experience, people are hiding things whenever they're dressed like this and didn't make sense, goes on. Finally, to the case that I think is a pretty good case that the state relies on as far as the factual similarity, and that is the one from Arizona, the Castanos case. Castanos is a passenger, like our guy, and he's outside of the vehicle and it's being impounded, and he consents to a search. There are a few things that are a little different. One, under statute, the officers have to impound the vehicle in this circumstance, and the case actually cites to that statute, which I didn't really think about until I read this case in preparing for oral argument, to ask the question, why are police impounding the vehicle in our case in the first place? The testimony was that the vehicle was parked legally. There were no warrants or anything for the fellow that owned the vehicle, Mr. King, that was there on scene. And I understand we're so used to officer makes an arrest of the driver, we impound the vehicle, take it on, you know, that's just how things are done. It never occurred to me that it's peculiar that they just take this guy's truck from him. And do they have any good reason to do that? Are there any instrumentalities of a crime or any reason the police need to take his car or truck from him? And so why couldn't Mr. King just have his own vehicle towed, which would be the prudent thing to do if you don't have financial responsibility? It's legally parked. You go ahead and have it towed. But that's not something that was argued at the motion to suppress, but something that sort of rubbed me the wrong way when I was reading this Arizona case. The Arizona case is not helpful beyond that skeleton of facts. We don't know the length of time between when they get the people out of the car and when they get them behind the car, tell them the car is going to be towed. We don't know any of the surrounding circumstances. It's just about a paragraph long where it says, we've got to get them out of the car. We take them behind the car. I asked to search them, and I searched them, and they found what they ended up charging Mr. Castanos with, which was drug paraphernalia, some baggies that were in his pocket. Which, another interesting thing about this case, he got 2.5 years for drug paraphernalia, which is kind of insane relative to our $500 fine. But, you know, I guess that's what you can expect from Arizona. In the explanation of the court, there's also the phrase that the search was for officer safety. There's not really an explanation as to what gave rise to the officers having a safety concern there. The way that our courts have articulated a search for officer safety is you have to have reasonable suspicion, you have to have articulable facts for an officer to search a person pursuant to officer safety. And so the procedure is done based on officer safety in this Arizona case, without any supporting facts. I don't find it to be helpful because of the sparsity of facts. In our case, however, we have a man that is in the vehicle for a period of time while there is an investigation about the driver's ability to legally drive, and he provides, although he doesn't have to, he complies, provides his wallet and information to the officers that are there. He stays in the vehicle as he is guarded by one of the officers, I believe they say posted next to the vehicle's door, and ultimately the driver is arrested. He is taken from the vehicle. Officers still have his wallet, some other personal effects, just like I guess anyone would know that if an officer has your driver's license, your wallet, or wherever it is, that you know you can't leave till you get that back. But he gets out of the car, and the officer begins questioning him and does ask him about whether he will turn out his pockets, and whether he will allow him to pat him down. And so we have the concern about whether the detention is unlawfully extended for King at this point. The state's heading cleverly says 128 seconds or something like that. But it really drives home the point here in that it is 128 seconds beyond the lawful purpose of the stop. Beyond.
What role does the fact that Mr. King asked if he was free to call someone to pick him up, what role does that play in the analysis?
That has a very important role in the analysis in that before the officer asks him questions, Mr. King says, can I have my wife come pick me up? And the officer says, no. And that's after the officer says, no, you can't do that. He continues his investigation. Essentially a fishing expedition for other criminal activity. And so you have, from the perspective of any reasonable person, King gets out of the car, officers have his wallet, he's just seen the driver arrested, they're instructing him where to walk, where to go, and then he says, you know, can I get out of here? And the officers say no. It seems to be very clear from the record that he's not free to leave, or someone in his situation would not believe they were free to leave. And it's after this, after all this has occurred, that we have the officers fishing around trying to find something. And they end up finding the canister with two ends, or one end, I'm not sure. They're on the floor. So all of this that leads to the canister being on the ground is after the lawful purpose has been effectuated, and the only justification officers give for an after-the-fact justification officers give for wanting to search him and the state tries to squeeze in is nervousness. That's not enough for reasonable suspicion to be afraid of this fellow. After the search, during the search, we have, in the state's brief, they make mention of, or quite a bit of argument about, the knife that was on Mr. King. But, of course, this is something that is recovered during the search of Mr. King, after the lawful purpose is over and the detention has been extended.
Mr. Cofer, the state spends quite a bit of time in its brief arguing that King didn't preserve his complaints for appeal. How do you respond to that?
Mr. King did preserve his complaints for appeal in that Mr. Willett at the trial level was litigating the specific issue of the extension of the detention. Coming to sort of the end of the consent business, I really enjoyed the footnote 9 on page 17 of the state's brief, where it's sort of a graceful insult to Judge Gonzalez that the state can only assume that the trial court's reference to consensual encounter and consensual contact were intended as a reference to appellant consenting to the officers asking appellant if he would turn out his pockets and submit to a pat-down. Well, the judge clearly says in the findings that are located in the reporter's record 5051 that it is a consensual contact between law enforcement and Mr. King. It was a mistake by the judge, or misunderstanding of the state of the law as to whether there is a consensual encounter once someone is stopped, pursuant to a traffic stop and ordered from the vehicle. That is not as though Mr. King is a pedestrian out on the side of the road that an officer walks up to. But even if the court were to say, you know what, we're not inclined to follow the rationale that it's not a consensual encounter with authority, but he was somewhat of a pedestrian out there, and then that still implicates Terry, which was really the underpinning of all of this. The officer didn't have any reason to go up to this pedestrian or person that there's no reason to detain and say, let me search your pockets and turn out your pockets and I'm going to pat you down. The findings in the court by the trial court really didn't address what the parties were arguing. I think it was an attempt at being clever and getting around perhaps what the parties were arguing about. What was argued was the sort of clock watching, as it's been called, and I want to ask the court not to engage in that activity. Earlier this year in Hosey, I believe Justice Sirth wrote the opinion. It talks about the Supreme Court Rodriguez case and talks about the length of time, 7 minutes versus 10 minutes in that case, and gets into this worry about time. And none of the cases are willing to take a bright line on time, and the reason is it doesn't matter what the clock says. It's what the police officers do. And once they've gotten into this illegal area of detention, then what they do after that is either an illegal interrogation or illegal search, regardless of time. Actually, in Rodriguez, the court, the Supreme Court, and it's a great opinion written by Ginsburg, declines to extend the MEMS de minimis exception for this kind of activity. Whereas, well, the officer only took 128 seconds to do this unlawful thing, so it's not really that bad. They specifically decline to adopt the MEMS de minimis exception. Instead, they come down on law enforcement because they are using this illegal activity after the detention should have been over for crime hunting, for just regular ferreting out of any sort of criminal activity that they can find. I'll have a few remarks in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cofer. Curl.
May it please the court. I'm here to represent the state. My name is David Curl. I just have a few comments I want to make. First of all, Rodriguez versus the United States, which is discussed on page 23 of our brief, clearly says that part of a traffic stop is dealing with the tasks tied to the traffic infraction. And there's just no sensible argument to be made that that doesn't include inventorying and impounding the car. And we've cited, appellant tries to factually distinguish, or irrelevantly factually distinguish three cases we cited, the Willett case, the Rainey case, and the Valera case. They all clearly hold that delays that are caused by the need to impound the car are part of the traffic stop, and you cannot.
But what about Mr. King's request to leave?
Well, it doesn't matter for this point. If dealing with the impounding is part of the traffic stop, then he doesn't have a right to leave. So we're still dealing with the traffic stop. So I was going to talk about that later, but my response to that is that it's a question of historical fact what the significance of that request is. All the officer was saying is, I want to talk to you right now. He wasn't saying that you're detained. He just says, don't call your wife. I want to talk to you. And I don't think that that's a detention, is my specific response to that. But it's irrelevant for this point that the towing is part of the traffic stop. And you'll find nothing in appellant's brief and nothing he said here today that even remotely, no precedent that even remotely supports his idea that dealing with the impounding process is not part of the traffic stop. And it clearly is under the Rodriguez versus United States. Appellant briefly alludes to an issue about whether the impounding was legal. Well, he didn't ask us to justify the impounding at trial. That was never a part of his complaint. It's not a complaint that he's made on appeal, so it's just not an issue that's before the court. The officer testified on page 15 of volume 2 that they couldn't just leave the car there, and that was the only extent to that issue was addressed in the hearing, because that wasn't an appellant's complaint. He wasn't going after the impoundment. He was saying they couldn't speak to him. On page 25 of our brief, we discussed lots of Texas precedent that says that asking for a consent at the end of a traffic stop is not an extension of the traffic stop. Appellant has never responded to that. We've cited more recent cases, like a very recent Eighth Circuit case that says that you can talk to a guy after you've finished your traffic stop, and that's not an extension of the traffic stop. On page 30 of our brief, we talk about we didn't even really need his consent. They could frisk him just on the facts they knew. And Powell said,
what facts would those be?
Well, the officer said that he saw a knife clip in his pocket. That's a very strong support. The Court of Criminal Appeals just came out with a case that we cite in our brief where they say if you see a knife clip in the guy's pocket that you can frisk him. And that's what happened here, except in the case, I can't remember the name offhand, but in the Court of Criminal Appeals case, he just said he saw a clip, and they said that was enough. In our case, the officer said he saw a knife clip. And he did not, appellant says that he saw that after he pulled it out of his pocket. The officer said he saw that in his pocket. So that's very strong support. The officer said that he was walking funny. The officer said he was nervous. The officer never got any real identification from appellant. So he was out there in the middle of the night on the side of the freeway with a guy who was walking funny and had a knife in his pocket. And appellant's argument is that the officer should just turn their back on him and crawl around in this pickup truck for 20 minutes.
Well, wouldn't the safest thing to do would be to let him leave the scene?
Well, no, because it's dark out there. It's not like if they drove him 3 miles away and dropped him in the wilderness.
His wife come pick him up. Then he'd be gone. He couldn't be a threat, right?
Well, that wouldn't happen before the impoundment unless they're going to spend all night waiting for his wife to show up, assuming she even had a car. But, you know, I don't think that the law requires that the police make all these kind of accommodations. If somebody's a threat, they don't have to get away from him. They don't have to... They can search the guy if they have reason to believe he has a weapon, and I think they did. And they also had reason to believe that he was dangerous to them.
If the car is legally parked, what authority does the police department have to have it impounded?
They said it wasn't safe. Now, the question would be what the policy of the police department was, and since that was never, and I don't think you can leave your car parked on the shoulder of a busy street. I think the officers testified that it couldn't be left there.
Well, they did. They just said that. That's all they said. But my question is a little bit deeper than that. What authority, what law, what rule, what regulation gives police the authority to impound a vehicle that is legally parked? Because the officer also said it was legally parked.
Well, again, I don't know the answer to that. The it's really not a problem in our case because the legality of the impounding was not challenged. It wasn't. We would have litigated this if appellant had said that he had a problem with the police trying to impound the car. He didn't. His complaint was that they couldn't talk to him. So I think it's a little bit of an estoppel claim because he's not.
But you're using the impounding of the vehicle is the reason why the detention had to continue.
And the impounding of the vehicle was never challenged. So that's not an issue that's ever been litigated. And the appellant shouldn't be allowed to litigate it now when he didn't ask us to litigate it in the trial court. And I would assume
that... So we should just assume that the police have authority to do something without having...
Well, police impound cars when there's not a driver all the time. And I assume it's controlled by the police policy. But, you know, if you leave your car sitting on the side of a road for very long, it's going to get towed away by the police. But even if you don't like the fact that the impounding was part of the stop, they could still search this guy because they had reason to believe he had a weapon. I wanted to emphasize that footnote 9 in our brief was not intended as an insult to the trial judge, and I take exception to appellant's claim. I just point out that appellant, he seems to argue that Terry versus Ohio prevents police from walking up to somebody and asking them to consent to a search, and it certainly doesn't. You can walk up to anybody you want to and ask them to consent to whatever you want. It's not, you don't need anything to ask somebody if you'll let me search you. So, with that, we'll simply pray that the trial court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to bring the focus of the arguments to the findings of the trial court. The state relies on evidence that is in the record and then evidence that the state infers from the record. But if you look at the findings of the trial court, nothing about a weapon being the justification. There is nothing about why Mr. King could not leave the scene. The officer, and that's another point that's not in evidence, the officer doesn't articulate any reason as to why Mr. King must remain on the scene while they're going to inventory or impound the car. There's no discussion about a policy of law enforcement to keep people on the scene during this process. So if you reel everything back to the findings of the trial judge, there is just not there's just no real meat as to why the motion should have been suppressed. You have really someone, this consensual encounter, that's just contrary to the law. We still took the time to brief the facts and brief the arguments of the parties at the trial level, but at the end of the day, the judge took it upon himself to make specific findings and facts and conclusions of law. And we can't go back and sort of fix whatever it is that he did just because he happens to be wrong about the law. And that's what the state wants to do. And I think Mr. Cole could have written very, very compelling findings of facts and conclusions of law, and perhaps that's what should have happened. But that's not what happened in this case. The judge took it upon himself, he made these findings, and that's what we have now. Of course, in my brief, I say as a remedial measure, the court can send the case back, which I really don't want you to do, but the court can send the case back to the trial judge and have him make additional findings. You can do that as a remedial measure, but right now, as it stands, the findings do not support the argument of the state. They don't really even implicate the argument of the appellant. We're still grappling with the actual facts and the actual law that probably should have applied, but whenever you boil it down, the findings of fact, conclusions of law do not support a denial of the motion to suppress. And I would ask that the court remand with an instruction to grant the motion to suppress and allow this gentleman to get out of prison. Thank you.
Mr. Cofer, thank you. Mr. Curl, thank you both for your argument. We will stand in recess for about 20, 30 minutes before our 3 o'clock oral argument. You are free to go about your business, and we will.